Chapter 7. The Wall Within. Kerberos. Spaces. Battle Barge Throne of the Underworld, Trans-Plutonian Gulf. The wolves closed their jaws on Pluto as the Sons of Dawn fled. The Imperial Fists had prepared for flight. That much was clear. One moment, there were hundreds of ships spinning in the dance of weapon exchanges. Then, every weapon station and fortress moon still in the defenders' hands fired. Rolling volleys of shells and short-fused torpedoes shook the void and lit the dark with bubbling shoals of fire. The attacking ship's sensor systems chattered in distress as they filtered the sudden squall of energy spikes. And the volleys kept coming, rolling over the top of each other like the rising beat of drums. The Loyalist ships wheeled as one and turned, thousands of vessels coming together and diving for the inner system. The engine light of his fleeing enemies gleamed in the eyes of Horus Aximand as the throne of the Underworld cut through Pluto's orbit. It was a battle barge, not the equal of the great Gloriana-class ships, but still a monarch of destruction. Two companies of Sons of Horus stood ready in its holds, 1,000 of the Legion's best killers, and it mounted cannons that could hammer targets to ruin. The spear-tip force it led had been aimed at Kerberos, a primary strike to take the Fortress Moon's main batteries. That blow would now be left to others. The Newborn and the Fourth Legion could take their objectives and bear the cost, and there would be a cost. Even with the cover of their fleet gone, the Fortress Moons were still ship-killers. Tens of thousands would die to take them. That did not matter. All that mattered was that this gate to the solar system was in their hands. Aximand could see each of the next moves he had to make, all the gradations of victory and how to reach them. It was as simple as breathing. He understood it in his mind, but also with his soul. That was what had seen him rise in the Legion, his sheer tactical genius. There had been others who were better at the point and edge of killing, though they were few, but Aximand was able to measure war and to weigh possibility and then make decisions that won battles. He was Little Horus because his face had resembled that of the Primarch, but the deeper resemblance lay here, in his ease in the crucible of war. The face that had given him his half-mocking title had been flayed away, but the commander's soul beneath remained. Seeing the battle sphere of Pluto change, he already knew why and what to do. "Battle fleets, Ullinor and Shardspear, engage the fleeing enemy ships. Run them down. Fourth Legion battle groups divert and begin assault on Kerberos, Charon, and Hydra." Beside Aximand, Vul Bron sucked in a breath to speak. The veteran warsmith had survived the Iron Warrior's withdrawal from Crade, but a strike on the last transport had left him with a bloody cave in his side.
"They are not breaking," he rasped.
Compression pistons in his rebuilt torso hissed and released.
"The key values of their force and strength have not fallen to collapse. We should hold to our current deployment."
"No," said Aximand. "They are withdrawing. This is a battle they knew they would lose. They held for as long as they could, slowed us and bled us as much as they could, and now they will run to terror."
"The Dog Sons of Dawn do not run," said Vul Bron. "They hold past the point of sense. This is something else."
"They have other lines and defences to use," replied Aximand, "and billions of people who can die on their walls." He turned his flayed grin to Vul Bron. "What they don't have is ships. They cannot lose more. Their strength is their fortifications and the number of mortals who will fight for them. But fortresses cannot be moved. Their ships are the only way for them to redistribute their strength. They lose those ships, and all their strength is trapped." He turned and began to walk towards the doors that led from the bridge to the hoist down to the launch decks.
"So they are running, because they must, to keep their ships alive. And we will not let them escape."
"Where are you going?"
asked Volbron. "To draw my sword and bury it in their back," said Axamand. "One-third of your ships may join the pursuit, but the rest of the fortress moons are yours. Live up to your reputation. Take them now."
He could see his words light a fire in the cold eyes of the Iron Warrior's commander. Volbron understood what Axamand had explained. Of that there was no doubt. But the Iron Warrior's way of war moved like a glacier over stone. They had no time for such caution. The Ultramarines were coming, and with them all the enemies they had left undefeated in these years of war.
"As soon as the main defences fall, we shall bring the reserves through," said Volbron.
And Axamand could see that it was an act of will for the other warrior to not bite back. Good. The two chains that formed the Iron Warrior's bridle were loyalty and pride. Now pride would work to overcome caution.
"We should bring all the rest of our forces through the gate on an accelerated timetable."
"Agreed," said Axamand. "So ordered." The Imperial Palace, Terra. "Admiral." Su Kassen looked up into the face of the Huskarl. A black cloak hung from his shoulders, and snow leopard fur covered them. He held his brush-crested helm in his left hand, and his right rested on the pommel of a sheathed sword. His face was clean-shaven, his eyes hard but bright.
"Yes, Captain Arcamus," she said.
The name still felt strange to say to this young warrior, and for a moment she saw the face of the man who had borne the name before. Her friend. Bearded, unreadable, as immovable and eternal as a granite cliff. Then she blinked, and the new face nodded, as though seeing the memory in her eyes.
"Come with me, please, Admiral," he said.
She frowned and glanced around at the Grand Borealis Strategium. The circles of officers and tech priests did not look up. The shimmer of holo projections and the buzz of machines flowed on unceasing.
"General Gaze,"
she said to a lean-faced officer standing one step down from her station,
"you have the watch."
She stood and followed Arcamus as he walked from the chamber. She did not ask where she was going or why. That it was Arcamus meant that this was the Praetorian's will, and she would discover the reason soon enough. Two figures in massive amber-yellow terminator plate flanked the door they eventually reached. Arcamus paused for a second in front of them, and then the door to the chamber beyond opened. He stepped aside and motioned for her to enter. The room was circular, and wide enough that it would have taken her 20 strides to reach the opposite wall. Thick, embroidered curtains hung over tall windows. Dusty glow globes sent shadows across the domed ceiling above and the carpeted floor below. It smelled of pipe smoke and thyme soaked into rich fabric. Four figures looked up from the circular table as she entered. She knelt instantly.
"Stand, Admiral," said Rogaldorn.
She obeyed. Behind her the door closed behind Arcamus, and she heard the brief buzz of servos as he too began to kneel, and then stopped himself. There was a clack of ceramite as he saluted, fist to chest. She smiled inwardly. As one of the Huskarls, Arcamus did not kneel, unless his lord did. It was a rule that he was still getting used to. But, well, he might have knelt. Beside Rogaldorn stood Sanguinius, face grave beneath his golden locks, and with them the gilded presence of Constantine Valdor. The chief custodian looked up from the parchment-strewn table and gave Su Kassen a short nod.
"Admiral," he said,
his voice an echo of the gravity in Sanguinius's expression. Malkador, alone of the four, was seated. The Regent of Terra had never looked older to Su Kassen's eyes. The hood of his robe was lowered, and she could see the skin of his scalp through the white strands of his hair. The lines of his face looked to be cut deeper into his brow and cheeks, and the skin had drawn tighter over the bones of his skull. A jolt of shock ran through her as he looked up. There was pain in his eyes, and a distance that reminded her of the eyes of her father in the last days of life.
"Thank you for attending us here, Admiral," said Malkador.
His voice was as clear and steady as ever. A small smile twitched the edges of his mouth.
"Excuse my remaining seated."
"Of course, Lord Regent," she said.
"Oh, please, can we move past the tortuous formalities?"
Sue Kersen looked around at the sound of the voice. A woman in grey robes with chromed hair sat cross-legged on the top of a polished wooden cabinet. She was resting her chin on her hands. Her posture looked bored, but her eyes were alight and glittering. Sue Kersen knew who she was instantly, even though they had not met in person before. The woman was called Andromeda 17, and she was one of the last of the Selenar, a scion of the near-extinct lunar gene cults that had helped the Emperor raise the Space Marines from armies to legions. She was a specialist in empathic and non-linear reasoning, and was part of a hazy grouping of servants that existed between Dawn and Malkador. Sue Kersen knew Andromeda 17 by rising reputation, and disliked most of what she heard. Nothing that she saw of the woman in the flesh undid that impression.
"It's all right, Admiral," said Andromeda. "Despising me at first sight is what most people do."
Arcamus shifted, and if Sue Kersen had not known better, she would have thought that the Huskarl was trying to suppress a smile.
"Thank you for the attempt to leaven the mood, Mistress Andromeda," said Malkador, looking directly at Sue Kersen. "This is a council, Admiral, after a fashion, but not one that can involve the wider staff, you understand."
"In all honesty, I don't, my lord. I believe I am aware of all the dimensions of the defence, and the senior staff also knows all of those details. If it is a matter of trust..."
"It is not," said Rogaldorn. "It is a matter of perspective, of judgment."
Sanguinius looked at his brother Primarch for a second, and the gravity in his expression became a brief flash of raw emotion.
"It is not weakness, brother. Our limits are what make us."
Sue Kersen thought she saw something within Dawn's gaze then, like the flare of lightning hidden by a far horizon.
"What they are trying to say," said Andromeda, "is that they are struggling with some things that don't fit in the normal patterns of war."
"Specifically?"
asked Sue Kersen.
"Things unseen and incomplete," said Malkador,
sounding very tired suddenly.
"Shadows on the wall."
"If you would indulge us by summarizing the position, Admiral," said Valdor,
activating a micro-holo projector that spun a display of the solar system into the air.
"The enemy progresses through the gates of Pluto and Uranus as planned for," said Sue Kersen. "They have also, by other means..."
"By sorcery,"
injected Andromeda,
"inserted a large force above the plane of the solar system. That fleet has divided into two, with both elements making speed for the inner system, for us and for Mars."
"Why?"
asked Dawn. She looked at him.
"To divide our efforts, to put direct pressure on the inner system defences, while they take the gates off Pluto and Uranus. They pin us in place around the throne world, and pour forces in from the outer system, and overwhelm us."
"Will it work?"
asked Sanguinius lightly. Sue Kersen paused.
"It can work. In the end, my lord, they have numbers and mobility. It is just a question of time."
She paused, then decided to give voice to her suspicion.
"But you all know this just as well as I do. The enemy know that others are at their heels, that they do not have time. This battle for them must be swift, and our greatest defence is to slow them, to make them have to grind through every step they take forwards. This manoeuvre is much further in system than we would expect. It is extraordinary, but it is not enough. It will not work quickly enough."
She looked up and met Rogaldorn's gaze.
"And they will know that. They will know that we can defeat them with time, even if we lose these battles. So the question is, what are they doing that we cannot see?"
Dawn nodded.
"They are either blind or desperate, or there is another dimension that we do not see," said the Praetorian, "that I do not see."
"The warp,"
said Malkador simply. And Su Kassen could not miss the weariness in the word. They all looked at the regent.
This has always been a war fought on two fronts. One in the physical world, the world of guns and bullets and flesh. The other a war in the realm beyond the physical. A world of things that dream they were gods, and where power has different dimensions.
The wall without, said Dorn, and the wall within.
Indeed, said Malkador. And you have always known that, Rogel. But now Horus comes here not just in the physical realm, but in the warp.
He broke off and closed his eyes for a moment.
I can feel it and see it, just as you all can, just as every soul in the circle of the sun can. Fear and despair grow stronger and feed the storm that rides at Horus's back. This is just the prelude, the beginning. The storm builds still and has yet to break.
Sanguinius moved next to the old man and placed a hand on his thin shoulder. Malkador let out a breath and closed his eyes again as something spasmed across his cheeks.
And everything that happens here, said the angel, has an echo in the warp, in the beyond. In war, one might unleash terror to break the will of the enemy, or sow confusion. In this war, that terror is the end in itself. Everything they do must be seen as having two purposes, one we can see, and one we cannot.
Can you not look?
Su Kassen asked, looking at Malkador.
Forgive me, but like the beloved Emperor, you are...
I cannot see. There is a darkness in the warp, screaming, blinding and growing deeper. It is a constant pressure, and with every moment the pressure becomes greater. I cannot see.
The Emperor,
began Su Kassen.
The Emperor is our wall within now.
He and he alone, said Sanguinius.
He is holding it back alone.
And he can hold, said Valdor.
The chief custodian seemed to shiver.
At great cost. But he holds and protects.
Holds, said Su Kassen. Not triumphs?
That is triumphing, as things stand. Horus cannot win the battle within, said Malkador. And so his hope must be to break us without.
Then they will fail, said Su Kassen. The enemy do not have time. We will move primary fleet forces to intercept them, and even at great loss, they will not be able to have victory before Lord Gilliman arrives at their back.
She looked at Dorn.
I was preparing the fleet redeployment orders. I assume you are ready to order the phalanx into the line?
Dorn's face showed no expression.
Not yet, he said quietly.
My lord...
He knows, said Dorn.
And Su Kassen could see in the stillness around the table that they had arrived at the point they had been unable to resolve.
Horus knows all that we have said and seen already. He knows what we know of this battle so far, and he knows what we cannot see. And he is Horus.
Dorn looked at Sanguinius, and the two Primarch's gazes met. A small, sad smile formed and faded on Dorn's lips.
Was he ever less than brilliant? Can we assume he is less than that now? This is the question, said Valdor. For my judgment, we must proceed against what we can see, not what we can't.
Agreed,
said Su Kassen. Dorn looked at her sharply, but she held his gaze.
We have planned for this battle, my lord. We have laid the ground. You know better than I that the unexpected is inevitable. We must not let it lead us. We must be firm in purpose.
From behind her she heard Andromeda 17 give a snort of approval.
And if that is what Horus wishes us to do? For me to follow my nature, which he knows so well?
I don't see that we have a choice,
said Su Kassen. And that is one of the things that worries me more than anything, said Dorn softly.
He looked up and away, his gaze focused somewhere far beyond the tapestry-hung walls. Su Kassen felt a shiver run down her back at the implication in the words. In all her years at his side, she had never seen a crack of doubt in the stone of his being.
He needs to be allowed the moment of flight before he returns to the cage of necessity, said the memory of the Khan's voice.
With all respect, my lords, she said, there is no choice to make. We can only fight the war we can see, and so that is what we must do.
See, said Andromeda 17 from the side of the room, I told you she would set you true.
What else worries you, brother? Asked Sanguinius, frowning.
Dorn looked around the table, and then at the angel.
The same question that all of us have asked, but not spoken yet, said Dorn.
He looked at the hollow projection and gestured so that it shrank to a sphere that he could rotate with his fingers.
Where is Horus?
Silence answered. Dorn turned his gaze around the circle, slowly meeting and holding each of their gazes.
Just so, said Dorn at last. And there is no answer we can give, and no guesses that would give comfort.
He looked back at the holosphere hanging between them, and keyed a control on the projector. The image folded into an image of terror, turning to show its face through day and night. Locations marked in a rainbow of colour spread across its surface.
There are other matters to be discussed, he said.
The conference ended an hour later, the gathered masters of the Imperium leaving without formality.
Admiral, said Malkador, as Su Kassen made to go. A moment of your time.
Behind her, Andromeda 17 was just leaving. Su Kassen caught the Gene Witch's eye and saw that there was sorrow in her look. Sorrow, or perhaps pity. Then the door to the chamber closed. Then it was just her and the old man, who was the regent of the Imperium, alone in a long moment of silence. A thin sheet of parchment sat on the table in front of him, she noticed. It was a spool from an autoscribe, one of the types used for archive reports. A section of the words on its face had been underlined in red.
There is something that you should know, he said. Please. Sit down, Admiral.
Fortress Moon Kerberos, Pluto.
Breach in charge! Called Sajiran,
and one of his brothers charged forwards. Sajiran came around the corner and fired up into the cluster of rotor cannons set in the ceiling above the blast doors. Target runes went red in his helm. His brother with the breaching charge was past him. Sajiran fired. Bolt shells breathed from the barrel of his gun. Explosions burst amongst the rotor cannons. The rest of his squad was with him now, firing up at the defence weapons. The cannons fired back. A deluge of hard rounds hit the warrior to Sajiran's right and punched him back off his feet. Ceramite splintered. The warrior with the breaching charge was halfway to the door. 10 paces, a second sprint. One of the rotor cannons spun around. Targeting beams reached through the smoke. The cowled statue beside the blast doors trembled. Hidden seams in the bronze split wide with a boom of pistons. The ground shook again as a battle automaton stepped out from where it had stood behind the shell of the statues. Fuel cables snapped free of gun pods and limbs. Weapons rose with a melody of gears and a chuckle of building energy. Sajiran felt the moment blur as his heart kicked and stimulants flooded his veins. It had taken them hours to reach this point. They were deep in the core of the Kerberos Fortress Moon. The unbreakable heart of Pluto's defences had proved to be quite breakable in reality. It was just a question of the cost. With the Imperial Fists in flight towards the inner system, it had only been a matter of time before Kerberos's surface defences had failed. Then Iron Warrior's bombardment barks had torn a kilometre-wide chunk from its face with mass drivers, and waves of assault craft had poured into the breach even as debris was still spinning outwards from the wound. Half of the first wave had died in seconds. Those that did reach the crater ripped in the moon's flesh found the guns of battle servitors waiting for them. 500,000 dead. That was the cost of the first wave. 500,000 human soldiers pressed from mongrel clans of void pirates and shipwreckers. They served their purpose, though. A cohort of Iron Warriors Terminators had teleported into the main battery, still functioning close to the breach. It had cost 2 strike cruisers, but the Iron Warriors had paid without hesitation. The crews manning the mountain-sized guns were still loading and firing as the Terminators cut them down. The fire from the wounded side of the moon dwindled and fell silent. Ships slipped forwards, landing craft buzzing from their flight decks. Companies of Sons of Horus and battalions of Iron Warriors entered the battle as the first wave foundered. Masters of Signal had analysed the casualty and engagement data and chose targets as the gunships and torpedoes were in flight. Where the defenders were weak, where they had retreated, where their guns were stammering, there the legions struck like knives, plunged into already open wounds. Sajiran and his brothers had been in that second wave. Almost all were newborn, legion warriors of years or months. These last days of battle, though, had made veterans of them all, those that had survived. It was murder in the tunnels of the moon. Most of the defending troops that had not fled with the Imperial Fists were of Mechanicum stock, weapon servitors and modified machine helots. Individually, they were no match for a legionary, but they had numbers and time to prepare. Endless gun nests and traps met the assaulting troops, and the resistance increased the deeper they went. There was no retreat amongst the defenders. Either through programmed control or desperation or hate, they fought to the last. The floor and walls of the Fortress Moon shook and shook without cease. Its remaining gun batteries were still firing, even as the attackers bored into its heart. Across the orbits of Pluto, Kerberos's siblings were already falling, aflame, ringed by ships, their innards burning as the 4th and 16th legions cored them out, passage by passage. Pluto belonged to the War Master. It was just a matter of crushing the last fingers of resistance that still clung on in the face of the inevitable. Looking up at the automaton striding out to defend Kerberos's heart, Sajiran realised that he would not see that victory. He dived aside as the weapon on its shoulder fired. Blue light scored a line across the decking. He rolled. The beam struck 2 of his squad brothers. They vanished into dust and ash. Sajiran came up firing.
"Use the charge!"
he shouted into the vox as he fired. He could see his squad mate with the breaching charge running for the automaton's right leg. Bolt rounds splashed across the automaton's chest. Its gun mount rotated towards Sajiran. Energies lit within the barrel. An explosion enveloped the automaton's side. Sajiran staggered as the blast wave rolled through the air and floor. The automaton listed like a punch-drunk brawler. Smoke and flame snaked up its side. Pipes vented burning oil from beneath torn armour. Sparks crawled across its body. But it did not fall. It straightened, gun mount swivelling to aim. Sajiran felt a snarl of laughter and rage come to his lips. He raised his bolter to fire a last shot of defiance. The automaton froze. Sajiran's last bolts smacked into its torso. For a heartbeat, it did not move. Then it folded to the ground with a sound of releasing pistons and unwinding gears. Sajiran stared at the machine as it settled onto the ground, still burning. On the ceiling, the rotor cannons stopped firing, their barrels spinning on momentum in the sudden silence.
"What?"
began one of the other survivors from the squad. But the question vanished behind a rolling chorus of clanks and thuds. Every door leading off the chamber thumped open. The air began to stir and billow as wind blew through the space. The vox began to chatter with voices. Every system across the Fortress Moon had just shut down. Every door had unlocked, and all the batteries had fallen silent at once. A clanking boom trembled the deck as the blast doors to Kerberos's core started to open. Meter-thick layers of metal peeled back one after another.
Sajaran found himself rising, stepping forwards. "Brother!" called one of his squad mates, but he ignored the word. Silent dark filled the space beyond. He stopped on the threshold, paused and removed his helm. The air smelled of burnt plastic and hot wiring. He could see small lights winking on banks of machines now, blue, red, and green, stuttering in time with the pulse of the machines. The chamber was vast. He could feel it in the air, even though his eyes could not reach to the edge of the shadows. He took another step, gun low but ready. Nothing moved. A stutter of lightning split the dark, rolling up the side of a vast metal sphere at the heart of the chamber. Sajaran paused again. There was another note in the air, a high vibration that ached in his teeth. The vox chopped between the voices of Iron Warriors and Sons of Horus legionaries. The moon had gone dead, as though something vital had been cut. Another arc of lightning flashed up the side of the metal sphere ahead. The ache in his teeth was a shrill call in his ears now. He took another step. Another flash, and he saw the servitors hanging from their cable links. He nudged one with the barrel of his bolter. It swung slackly. Its weapons clinked, as though something vital had been cut. Three flashes of lightning, and in the white glare he could see the tech priests lying on control gantries high up on the sides of a forest of smaller metal spheres. Red lights were winking on control consoles. Something cut, or something drawn back, like the backdraft of a fire, or the inhalation of a beast. Cold lanced into his core. He turned and began to run for the doors that were open to the rest of the moon, the moon they had spent blood and time taking, the moon that now was ringed with warships and filled with troops. His squadmates shouted at him, but he was calling into the vox, shouting through the chop and hiss that was rising in time with the buzzing in his ears. Behind him, lightning bolts flashed and flashed, bleaching the reactor chamber blinding white. And he knew it was too late, that these were the last stretched moments of his life, and that this war that had remade him had now come to claim him. A flash, brighter than lightning, and a sound beyond hearing that filled him for the endless instant before there was nothing. Strike Frigate Lacrimae, Pluto. Sigismund opened his eyes. The blade of his sword was cool against his forehead. He had waited in silence, his thoughts turned inwards. But now he needed to return to his purpose. The murmur of oath words filled the bridge of the Lacrimae. He lowered the sword, but did not sheathe it. Boreas and Ran's hollow projections met his gaze.
"The moment is here, brother," said Ran.
Sigismund nodded, feeling the words he was about to speak gain weight on his tongue.
"Turn the fleet," said Sigismund. "Cut them down."
Kerberos detonated. It was no small thing to destroy a moon. The agents of the Fabricator General had resisted. To them, such an act was a violation, the killing of machines, a tragic loss of function and knowledge. Rogel Dorn had not relented, and so it was done. Munitions had arrived on Pluto's moons in vast numbers. Their magazines swelled with macroplasma cores, blocks of explosive and cylinders of accelerant. All of it had been done so that it would seem part of preparations for the coming war. The eyes of Horus amongst the defenders saw only stores arriving for a siege, and did not ask or think any more of it. The tech priests had done their work, layering in time-delayed overload routines into primary, secondary, and tertiary reactor controls. Charges were set in the bloated munition stores, all synchronized to a single command that would make them all parts of a single great act of destruction. The data gin that the tech priests created to enact the design had needed to gestate for months in the data looms of deep void facilities, and when it was complete, all those involved had the memories of what they had done removed.
It was a thing of artistry and genius, a hymn to the limits of knowledge and machinecraft. But none of those who wrought it would ever wish to claim their due for their work. They gave it a name, though, a designation that wove its purpose with a whisper of forgotten dread. They had named it Vanth Primus Null. As the Imperial fists retreated, the data gin had begun its work. Incubated in the core data reservoirs of each fortress moon, it uncoiled into full being. Tentacles of code in a dozen machine languages reached through data cables and photon lines and noospheric connections. From system to system it spread. It overwrote command codes and retasked servitors. Data altered, and cycles of unmaking began in the spirit of each machine it passed through. Even on the moons already in the attacker's hands, Vanth Primus Null carried on doing its work, increment by increment, silent and unseen. By the time the Iron Warriors and Sons of Horus had begun their assault on Kerberos in earnest, the process was already past the point where it could be undone. The blast wave of Kerberos's death killed 205 ships. Void shields vanished, armour melted, chunks of wreckage the size of mountains tore through hulls, static rolled through the Vox channels. Seconds later, Hydra and Charon followed their brother. The magazines and fuel of hundreds of warships added their fire to the inferno. Detonations leapt between the vessels manoeuvring too close to the moons. Explosions chained all the way back to the Chthonic Gate. Ships at the edge of the blast scrambled to get clear. Order vanished. Mayhem and death ringed the last planet of the solar system, and Pluto shook in its orbit. Out in the reach, towards the sun, the ships of the Imperial Fists turned. Thrusters flipped them back over in mid-flight. The Sons of Horus vessels pursuing them ploughed onwards, even as the realization of what had happened rippled through them. On the bridge of his ship, Horus Axamand saw the fleet that had been fleeing but a moment before turn and roar back directly towards him. At his back, the shouts of officers and servitors filled his ears. Behind his mask of flayed skin, understanding slid into him, cold and sharp. The guns of his ships roared as the fleet of the First Sphere met them head-on. Bab Bastion, the Imperial Palace, Terra.
Admiral?
Yes? Su Kassen blinked, not looking at where Arkema stood just inside the closed door out of her quarters. She could almost feel the Space Marine's discomfort.
There is a signal, he said.
Of course there is. She was still staring into the open pistol case on the stone mantel. The weapon's pepperpot barrel gleamed blue-black in the low light of the single glow-globe she had lit. Why had she come back here? She was needed in the command bastion. There were things that needed to be done. Time would not stop or slow for this instant. Why would it? Death was history, its tread and pulse. No one death would shake it from that course. But here she was. Arkemus had gone with her when she left Malkador's chamber. She had begun to walk, and the Imperial Fist had silently followed. She had not questioned why, but a part of her mind that felt like it belonged to someone else wondered if Dawn had asked him to go with her, to watch over her in this moment. She did not consider it for long. There was no space in her for thoughts, just the words of the recent past ringing in her ears. So she had let the Huskarl walk with her, and did not think about why. It was quiet. The last weeks had stripped the continent city of its crowds and bustle. Nothing moved in its halls except the twitching guns of the weapon servitors that watched everything with crystal eyes. Stablights washed across the high windows of the Silesian cloister as they crossed into the northern circuits. It was night outside, she realized. The time had been drained of meaning over the last days. What did it matter if the sun was rising when your mind was focused on planets halfway across the system? On she walked, not minding her path or steps. The places she passed through were empty. When she did see other humans, they moved in clusters, flanked by soldiers. She recognised the green and silver cloaks of the Key Helic Guard, the crimson armour of the Inferalti Hussars, and the grey and ochre fatigues of the Cordesh cavalry. The regiments of the Old Hundred deployed within the walls in what might be the last days of the Imperium they helped found. Nothing and no one moved unescorted within the palace, except the Tenebrae. Malkador's eyes and ears watched and listened from the shadows and passed like breaths of chilly wind as they hunted whispers. Hundreds of millions lived in the palace, tending its functions, from those holding high bureaucratic office to the serfs performing the lowest menial tasks. Most remained, attending to the crucial duties that kept the Emperor's seat of power working. But whatever solace their positions had given them before offered little comfort now. Every district and enclave had been locked down. Food, water, and information had become rationed as the intra-system convoys halted, and the reality of war, often distant, had made its presence known. A black market had sprung up within days. Su Kassen had read the reports. A senior supervisor of records caught crossing security lines with the water he had bought with the jewelled rings from his fingers. The high matriarch of a noble scribe clan who had refused to turn back from a containment line, striding past with a laugh, only to be gunned down. The northern records district that was still burning after a chemical stove had exploded. It would only get worse with time. And then...
Are you all right, Admiral?
She had blinked and looked up at Arcamus. The Huskarl had glanced down at her.
It's just that I'm not certain as to your purpose in walking the palace.
They were crossing a stone bridge that spanned a ravine between two internal palace walls. A chilly wind blew across her face. She blinked at the strangeness of the question, and the double strangeness of who was asking it. She frowned, not certain how or whether to answer.
"I apologize," said Arcamus after a moment.
"I should not have intruded." They lapsed back into silence. They walked on, through passages narrow enough to brush Arcamus's shoulder guards, and others wide enough that a platoon of soldiers could have marched down them line abreast. Most were dark, lit by a scattering of lamps, or not at all. Fuel and power, like everything else, was a resource that now had to be hoarded and spent with care. All corridors and spaces were empty, echoing. After half an hour, Su Kassen realised that they had recrossed their path several times. A while after that, she finally had to admit to herself that she had no idea where they were. As if in answer to that fact, they joined a spiral stair of brass and began to climb. Arcamus had not tried to guide her, but just followed. At last, she realised that her steps had taken them back to the Bab Bastion, and so she had found herself staring down at the shot pistol.
"We always return to our cages," she said to herself.
Across the room, Kellick stirred his feathers in reply.
"Do you wish something?" asked Arcamus.
"Nothing,"
she said, still not turning.
"I will just be a moment."
There were scratch marks on the pistol's trigger guard, she noticed, silver metal showing through blue-black. Hundreds of gauntleted hands holding the bone grip had made those scratches as their fingers curled around the trigger. The trigger guard itself was big too, enlarged to fit a digit wrapped in void armour. She wondered how many people had called the gun their own, how many had died with it in their grasp. She looked at the empty space in the velvet beside the gun, the empty outline of its twin. She reached out, as though her fingers would find something in the space that her eyes could not see.
"I am sorry," Malkador had said. "We must have had this information for a while. For years. But the connection was never made."
She had not looked up from the scroll of parchment in her hands. It was thin enough to be translucent, she realised, the black machine-scribed letters seeming almost to float. so insubstantial, so unreal.
"Why now?"
she had heard herself ask, then looked up at Malkador. The regent's eyes were steady on hers.
"The Khan made a specific request, a demand, actually, that we find anything and everything we could. He seemed to think it important that if there were answers to be had, you had them. I agree. Now, of all times, we must be certain of ourselves."
She had looked back at the parchment, at the words that had been highlighted with a neat line of red ink.
"Wreckage, assay, confirm warship Thunderbreak destroyed, with all hands while trying to flee from the Istvan system. Indications of command mutiny by traitor elements in crew, leading to ship's loss of power and destruction by main gun force of traitor vessels. Peripheral indications that captain had ordered ship to break from Horus's force."
"I..." she had begun to say, and felt a numbness soak in from her skin.
"I need to get back to my command."
"Of course," said the regent,
and was standing before she could protest. The effort sent a twinge of pain across his face. He walked with her to the door, leaning on his staff for each step.
"It is wrong,"
she said, as they reached the door and it hinged open. He stopped and looked at her.
"This is one of thousands of tens of thousands of frontline loss reports. There will be others, Lord Regent. Who knows how many millions waiting for news that has already become lost in history? That is wrong."
He nodded.
"War makes the simplest failings cruelty, Admiral."
"Yes," she said. "It does."
She lifted the pistol out. Its weight, once so familiar, now felt different. She looked at it, sitting on her palms. Captain Kalia Su Kassen on 2, killed in action, Istvan. That is what the updated record would read. An end of sorts, she supposed.
"Admiral, the rating of the signals has increased to Vermilion Aleph 4, said Arcamus. "Your presence and response are required."
She took the ammunition cylinder from the case, opened the breech and snapped it into the pistol. A single smooth movement readied it and pulled the safety off. One squeeze of the trigger and a blizzard of metal shards would rip anything closer than 20 strides into tatters. Not a clean way to die. She hefted it. In her mind she saw Kalia accept its twin from her hand and felt the awkward silence deepen as she tried to find something to say and her daughter tried to find a way of responding.
"Admiral?"
She looked around the shadow-filled room, released the safety catch and unreadied the weapon.
"That belt and holster there on the door. Hand it to me."
Arcamus blinked once and then did as she asked. The weight of the pistol settled on her thigh as she walked from the room and mounted the stairs back up to the Bab Bastion's command chamber.
"I am proud of you,"
she had said at last. Kalia had looked at the weapon, a thing that had spent more time in her mother's company than she ever had. Su Kassen had thought her daughter was about to say something. Then Captain Kalia Su Kassen on 2 had come to attention and bowed her head.
"I am honoured, Admiral,"
she had said, her voice perfect in its formality. She reactivated her direct vox and data link. Messages and command-grade transmissions began to ping in her ears. She cut them off and looked around at Arcamus. The Space Marine would have been monitoring the communication flow and parsing the situation while he waited.
"Situation precise," she said.
"The First Sphere Fleet has begun the counterattack at the Chthonic Gate," he said. "The crown of Pluto's moons is burning."